Amen. Thank you, Miss Emily. We appreciate that. We're going to be in Revelation chapter 18 tonight. Revelation chapter 18. I'm going to try to make my message simple because this passage really isn't that complicated. And so we're going to try to make it not more complicated than it needs to be. Somebody must have thought Pastor was preaching because there was two gigantic Reese's peanut butter cups on the pulpit. But here's the thing. If you give Pastor Reese's and I'm preaching, it doesn't have the same effect. So I'm making no promises to be any shorter because anyway, so there's that. But but this message probably isn't going to be as complicated. If I'm longer, it won't be as hard to listen to at the very least, because this isn't a complicated message, because chapter 18 of Revelation is connected directly with chapter 17. And so they really go together, and we're going to get to there in just a second. As I was reading through this passage, though, there's a very simple truth that I want us to see, but it reminded me of an Old Testament story that we're all very, very familiar with. All the way back in Genesis chapter 19, we have an interesting story that many of us have heard in Sunday school growing up our whole life. Abraham has moved into the land of Canaan several chapters before. And by faith, he left Ur and Haran, and here he is in Canaan. And he brought his family with him. Only a couple people. He brought his wife, and he brought his nephew, Lot. Now, we give Lot a really hard time, but, you know, there's a lot of family of Abraham, and Lot's the only one living with him, and God blessed Lot. He did. The whole reason that the story we're about to hear actually shows up is because Lot, along with Abraham, they just had so much stuff, they were running into each other. And so Abraham says, Lot, we gotta split. We got to have our own property. You go one way, I'll go another way. You pick which way you want. And so he points one way, he points another way, and Lot goes a third way, and he sees the plains near Sodom and Gomorrah. Historically, Sodom and Gomorrah was actually one of the most prestigious towns of that area, really, at that time in history. And there was a lot going on. There was a lot of trade. There was a lot of commerce. In chapter 14, we see a big war going on, and Sodom and Gomorrah is really at the forefront of the whole thing in leadership. And so it's a really happening town. But Sodom and Gomorrah is wicked. And those words, Sodom and Gomorrah, are used for the rest of the Bible as the personification of a wicked place to be and a place that God would destroy. Of course, Abraham has this whole conversation with the angels that come to him, who's one of them at least, is probably God himself who's talking to him. And he asks God to spare the city for the sake of Lot and his family. And there wasn't any righteous people there, but for the sake of Lot and his family, and for the sake of Abraham, he still sends the angels into Sodom to get Lot out. We find Lot not living near Sodom. We find Lot living in Sodom. We find Lot living at the gate. Lot had built a family. Lot had built a life. And Lot had built a career in Sodom. But nonetheless, a little bit of credit to Lot. A little, not a lot. Sorry, that was not on purpose. A little credit to Lot. When they come down, he hesitates, but then he goes and tells his family, we need to go. But they don't take him seriously. They laughed at him like he was one who mocked. Sodom's not going to be overthrown. Everything's going to be fine. We'll just stay here. And so he convinces them that they do need to go. But yet, as the story continues, the angel, it's time. It's time now. We need to leave now. And the Bible says this, while he lingered. He knew it was going to fall. He knew it was going to be destroyed. He knew it was wicked. He didn't disagree with any of that. But it was where his life was. It's where his family was. It's where his career was. It's everything he knew now. And so he lingered. And the Bible says, out of mercy to him, they dragged him out. And in the morning, the story goes over to Abraham, and he walks out in the mist of the morning and looks across the plain to see the smoke rise from Sodom that has fallen. While he lingered. Now, this is interesting. So we're in the book of Revelation. And without summarizing the entire book, the Antichrist has risen all the way in the future. This book is about what's going on down the road. This is written to seven churches who are so frustrated with the persecution and the power of ungodly people. And so God promises them, hey, one day I will take care of everything, so it's worth it to be faithful to me. That's the point of the book. And we see the Antichrist rise and the false prophet rise, but the whole tenor of the book is they will fall one day. And so we see all the judgments coming on the world from the seals, and then we expand the last seal to see all the trumpet judgments, and we expand the last trumpet to see all the vial judgments. And when we get to the end of chapter 16, the last vial of judgment is poured out on the earth, and the Bible says it is done. Jesus has come, and his kingdom is all the kingdoms of men have fallen. But as is Revelation's way, it expands on what that means. And in chapter 17 and 18, it talks about how in the process of him taking back the world and giving it to his people, the wicked system of Babylon will fall. In chapter 17, where we were last time about a month ago, it really focuses on religious Babylon. How the thinking of men that goes all the way back to Babel, I will build my own tower, I will make a name for myself, has permeated all of the bad thinking and philosophy of man, and that will fall. Chapter 18, though, focuses more on political Babylon. At this time, Antichrist has built a system for himself. He has built a government, he has built a palace, he has built a city, and while it might be political as a system, it's also political as probably a city itself. And so as we're focusing in on the failure of this bad system of men, chapter 18 shows how Babylon falls in its political system. So I want us to be in verse number 1. So I'm not going to emphasize some of these points because we've seen some of these things in chapters past. Verse number 1. After these things, everything we saw in chapter 17, I saw another angel come down from heaven having great power, and the earth was lightened with his glory. Of course, there's always a debate about who this is. Some people think it's Christ because he has glory and he has great power, which means great authority, exousia, not strength. But we see Jesus in the next chapter too, and nobody debates that it's him. So I tend not to think that it's him. It doesn't matter. Verse number 2. He cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the Great is fallen, and is become the habitation of devils, and the hold of every foul spirit, and the cage of every unclean and hateful bird. We're going to get back to that. All the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. We saw that picture all the way back in chapter 14. And the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. They have been unfaithful to their God through the bad thinking of Babylon. And the merchants of the earth have waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. Now look at verse 4. I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. He tells his people to do two things. Avoid her ways, so you can avoid her consequences. His people. It reminded me of the end of the book of Jeremiah when it talks about the fall of old Babylon. He says, flee out of the midst of Babylon and deliver every man his soul. Be not cut off in her iniquity. For this is the time of the Lord's vengeance. He will render unto her a recompense. He goes on, Jeremiah goes on, he says, Babylon hath been a golden cup in the Lord's hand that made all the earth drunken. The nations have drunken of her wine, and therefore the nations are mad. Babylon is suddenly fallen and destroyed. Howl for her, take balm for her pain, if so be she may be healed. Now, all the way at the end of the chapter before, he compares that just like he did to Lot. As God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah, And the neighbor cities thereof, saith the Lord, so shall no man abide there, neither shall any son of man dwell therein. What he does is he connects the fall of this wicked, wicked city, Babylon, in Jeremiah's day, to the fall of the wicked, wicked city, Sodom and Gomorrah. And the book of Revelation picks up this same concept of Babylon, the wicked, wicked city that we can choose to be a part of or be separate from. And here at the end of the book of Revelation, he says, come out of her, my people. Now, the whole book of Revelation, the idea of the book, is that we're all waiting for the wicked systems of man to fall, right? We are looking forward to Jesus making all things right. He opened the book to make all things new, and we want all things to be made new. But as I've said, chapter after chapter after chapter in this book, if Jesus is going to make all things new and make all things good, he has to undo the things that were before, which means some of his people who have been living in Babylon have to be willing to allow it to fall. We're used to Babylon standing in our life. It's what makes up our life. It's in every store we go to. It's in the jobs that we work at. It's just part of the systems. And yet, like Lot, we've allowed it to become a part of who we are. We've built a life in this world. We've built a family in this world. We've built a career in this world. And if Babylon were to fall, some of our life would fall with it. And so what do? We agree, but we linger. We know it's falling. We know the fire is going to rise. We know that tomorrow we're going to be standing on a nearby mountainside watching all the smoke rise into the air from the destruction of this wicked, wicked system of man. But we built a life there, so we linger behind. The Bible describes how Lot feels. Oh, I don't think Lot actually had that much tension in his heart. Yeah, he did. 2 Peter chapter 3 describes 2. 2 Peter chapter 2 describes how Lot felt. He says he lived in Sodom, that just man. He says he vexed his righteous soul from day to day in hearing and seeing their unlawful deeds. The word vex has the idea of torture. It bothered him. It did. It bothered him living in Sodom. Getting up every day and looking out at all the wickedness of his co-workers and the people around him, but he built a life there. And so he lingered nonetheless. I'm not asking whether you're bothered by the wickedness of this world. We can have a whole other message. We can have a whole other conversation about the sin that's in our own life. What I am saying, though, is sometimes we're attached to Babylon more than we think that we are. We'll agree with Lot, it needs to fall. But then we stay. This is what that passage says in 2 Peter chapter 2. It says, right after that, the Lord knoweth how to deliver the godly out of temptation and to reserve the unjust unto the day of judgment to be punished. He says this, if you are my people, you can let Babylon fall and not be partakers of its ways, so you're not partakers of its consequences. You can. God is able to give your family plenty of things to do without you having to fill your life with Babylon. God is able to give you a job that will plentifully provide for your needs without you being required to live in Babylon to do it. God is able to give you true and deep relationships in your life without you having to go to Babylon to find them. But we're like Lot, who went near Sodom, then lived in Sodom, and then needed Sodom. We've lived near Babylon because that's the world we live in. But then we have moved into Babylon, and now we think we need Babylon. And so God says to his people in chapter 18, he says, come out. And this is the title of my message. Let Babylon fall. Let it fall. It's okay. You do not need it. I want the wickedness of this world, especially the political system. Aha, yes, I'm with you on the bad politics. I will agree with you there. I want all that to fall. Yeah, we want freedom. We want less taxes. We want all the people in Congress to agree with our political opinions. But some of us don't actually want Babylon to fall, because then some of the movies and shows we like won't be on the TV anymore. Like, no, I'm okay with inflation going down. That's fine. But I still need some of the things that I enjoy from Babylon. We're okay with things being easier and not being afraid to go out at night. We're okay with not not being worried to let our kids play in the yard, but if Babylon falls, then we might lose the job that we've worked really hard for because our job works for Babylon. If Babylon fell, 50% of our activities would be gone. We don't have nothing to do. Oh, we're okay with not being afraid anyone is going to murder or steal from us. We want things to be easy. We just don't want the world to be there at the same time. See, we want Revelation to end with Jerusalem standing and Babylon standing at the same time. And so we can enjoy Jerusalem and we can visit Babylon whenever we need. So if Jerusalem is going to stand at the end of the book of Revelation, then Babylon has to fall. You can't have both. And so let it fall. So quickly tonight, we'll see. I have three reasons why we should let Babylon fall. Number one, let Babylon fall because, this one's easy, it is certain that it will. It is certain that it will. Let me reread verse, well, actually I haven't read it yet. Verse number 7. Go down to verse number 7. Talking about Babylon, how much she has glorified herself, lived deliciously, so much torment and sorrow give her. For she saith in her heart, I sit a queen and am no widow, and shall see no sorrow. Therefore shall her plagues come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she shall be utterly burned with fire. For strong is the Lord God who judges her. Babylon, the great harlot, yells, I'm a queen. I am no widow. That means I'm not destitute. I'm not going to be on the bottom of the heap. I'm always going to be on the top. I will not have any sorrow. She fully believes that she will last forever. But her plagues shall come, look what he says, in one day. One day she's standing, and one day she falls. You know, it's funny. Have you ever watched a movie, and it's got you get to the end, and there's this really intense scene that's there, and you know it's going to be there. You've watched it 20 times. It's your favorite movie. And yet every single time, you're on the edge of your seat like, don't do it. Don't do it. Oh, man. You know it's happening. You know the whole story. And yet you're still wondering whether or not the outcome's going to be the same. Like somebody shimmied into the system, some different ending that you're not expecting. And the same thing goes for us. We know the end of the story, but as Christians, we live in a world where we're under the impression that the world around us will never fall. It's going to be there forever. It just seems so solidified and so stable and so powerful. And so we're willing to give into it because it seems like it has the upper hand. Here's the problem. The history of the world is nothing but a continual history of giant powers that everyone thought was going to last forever, rising and falling. Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, for example, centuries there, the Ottomans, the French, the Spanish, the British, America, and every single time you put yourself in one of those countries, you think, well, it's going to last forever. We just have to do what they say. But every single one of those has risen to power and has lost its power. And the same will be true for that kingdom in the end of the book of Revelation. Everyone's going to walk around thinking Babylon, new Babylon's going to last forever. The Antichrist kingdom's going to last forever. He has control over the whole world. No one has done that, and it will only last for a few years. When you read all the kingdoms of men in Daniel, for example, that one's the one that's always given the short amount of time. They're tacked on the end. And just because it feels like it has power doesn't mean that it's going to last forever. You know what doesn't fall? The church. I will build my church and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. He says all the kingdoms of men, they're going to be prevailed against and they're going to fall. And yet we still give in to Babylon because we think that it's going to keep on going. And we will benefit from giving this world our allegiance. Now, speaking of that, I'll mention it. We're going to read it here in just a second. But in the ensuing part of the chapter, there's three different groups of people who stand back and they watch as the city of Babylon falls apart and the smoke rises into the air. And they do two things. They weep and they stand afar off. I don't know why that's important, but they do both of those things. Kings do that. Merchants do that. And shipmasters do that. We're going to talk about each of those here briefly at the end. but every single one of them expresses how they feel about this moment. And each one of them says, in 1 hour, thy judgment is come. They all say that. Every one of them is surprised. Every one of them mourns the loss in their life because Babylon has fallen, and they all express the same thing. Wow, it happened so quickly. It seemed fine yesterday, and here, gone. Everyone, in 1 hour. They thought yesterday that they were going to be secure in Babylon, and then tomorrow, they have nothing. Look at how the Bible illustrates how quickly and how easily Babylon will fall. Look down to verse number 21. Look at verse 21. A mighty angel took up a stone, like a great millstone, like just a real big, heavy rock, and cast it into the sea. Splash. Saying, thus, with violence, shall that great city Babylon be thrown down and should be found no more at all. He says this, you know what you think is never going to fall because somehow God's too weak to overcome it? He says, what you think is going to last forever because it's built on what man's power has will be just as easily overthrown as I can pick up a rock and throw it into the lake. That's it. That's all that it needs. This reminded me of a story in history. So Xerxes I, his dad Darius from Persia, he had fought with the Greeks. The Greeks are rising in power, and he's worried about that. And he doesn't do so great. So his son Xerxes I, who we know as Ahasuerus from Esther, in the first few years of his reign, thinks, I'm going to put them down. So he has to go to Thermopylae, and in order to get to Thermopylae, he has to get across the Dardanelles. And so he thinks, what better way than to build a bridge? So he's very, what's the word? It doesn't matter. He's trying to be very organized in everything that he's doing. So he's going to have the bridge built ahead of time. So he's got a bunch of people that go down to the Dardanelles, and they build a bridge made out of dirt and stones and rocks and whatever, and so that it's ready for their massive, unprecedented army of 300,000 men once they get there. And it's a funny historical moment because they get there only to find that the bridge has just been washed away by the water. And Xerxes does the funniest thing. He takes a whip. How many of you know this story? He takes a whip and he beats the water like he's mad at it. And all the men curse at it like, stinking ocean, you took our bridge. And that's what they did for a while. Then they built a new bridge and they walked across. They went to try to fight with the Greeks. They lost. They turned around. They came back. Guess what happened to the bridge? No bridge. And they had to build it again. For some reason, he was under the impression, I'm just going to build a dirt bridge across the water, and it's just going to stay there for forever. And then just as quickly as it's built, it's gone. And he's surprised, and he's mad, and he's angry, and it's millstone. Everything we build can just as easily fall. And the Bible tells us that this will. Just as easily as that bridge was built and is swallowed by the sea, nations rise and fall. All Jesus has to do to make something tumble is to speak his word, which is what he does in chapter 19. This world is volatile. The lies and deception and sin that caused their foundation to be built on sand will cause their city to crumble. It will fall, and it will fall quickly. And when it falls, all the good that he promised its inhabitants is lost. I want you to look at the end of the chapter. Look at verse 22 and 23. Verse 22 and 23. The voice of harpers. It sounds a lot like Jeremiah from my Jeremiah class. He talks about the same thing. The voice of harpers and musicians, pipers and trumpeters shall be heard no more at all in thee. And no craftsman of whatsoever craft he be shall be found any more in thee. The sound of a millstone, where you would make bread, shall be found no more at all in thee. The light of a candle shall shine no more at all in thee. The voice of the bridegroom and the bride shall be heard no more at all in thee. For thy merchants were the great men of the earth, and for by thy sorceries were all nations deceived. He says, Babylon will fall, and now there will be no more music, no joy. There'll be no craftsmen, no more creativity being expressed. No millstone. No bread to feed the people, no more light, and no more love. This is all the city has to offer. Joy, creativity, provision, light, and love, gone. in one day. As preachers, it's like pulling teeth to convince the church that truly all the things that we need in our life come from the Lord Jesus Christ and not from the world. And every one of those things. Joy is not found in the stuff of this world. It's found in Christ. He said, provision is not found at your job. It's found from Christ. He's the one that provides your needs. Light is not found by living in the darkness of this world. Light is found by following the way, the truth, and the life, the one who is the light of the world. True expression of individuality does not come by shoving ourselves into the mold the world tells us to fit in, but by expressing who God made us to be in his image. And everything he says here are all things God promises us. And here at the end of the story, Babylon promised all these things. I'll give you light of the candle. I'll give you music. I'll give you bread. And at the end of it, it fell and had no more at all. Did you see? It said that every time, I have no more at all. I will give no more at all. I have no more light at all. No more bread at all. Babylon cannot give you joy or light or provision or individuality or love. Babylon is certain to fall. So let it, because it will, and it has nothing to give us. Number two, this one's quick because it goes right into number three. Let Babylon fall because it needs to fall. It needs to fall. In this passage, he reminds us over and over again of all the wickedness that it had. Go back all the way to verse number two. He cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the Great is fallen, and has become the habitation of devils, the hold of every foul spirit, and the cage of every unclean and hateful bird. So there's two kind of ideas to this. One is that it's filled with the influence of demons. The other side with the birds, though, almost has the idea of imagine a city that is thriving and busy. People in the streets, a lot of stuff going on. Then you take that same city and make it desolate. What are you going to have? You're going to have crows, and you're going to have birds making nests in the streets, you know, like the old Western town. Caw, caw! You know, the reason why they throw that in there is desolate, and all the places where the people live, they're replaced by hateful birds that have taken its place. And so there's two ideas to that. One is that it's wicked, and now it's desolate because of it. Look at verse number three. For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. Look at verse 4. So he says, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partaker of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. Look at verse 5. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Reward her, even as she rewarded you. Double unto her, double according to her works. In the cup which she has filled, fill to her double. So as she, remember all the way back in chapter 14, she offers the wine of the sin to the world. The wine of Babylon is offered to the world. But to drink of the wine of Babylon is to drink of the wine of God's wrath. And he always connects the two. And he says, as she has filled it to the world, fill it back to her double. This goes all the way back to the law of Moses, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. It's just that what she has done to everyone else, Babylon, will be returned in kind. It says it needs to. Look at verse 7. How much she has glorified herself and lived deliciously. So much torment and sorrow give her. For she saith in her heart, I sit a queen and no widow and shall see no sorrow. Therefore shall her plagues come in one day, death and mourning and famine. She shall be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord who judges her. She glorified herself. Sound familiar? Like last chapter? I will make a name for myself. And so she has done that. And so it needs to be that she falls. Look at the very last verse of the chapter. After it falls, she reminds us, verse 24, and in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all those that were slain upon the earth. I will glorify myself. I will define right and wrong. She lived deliciously. Nobody can tell me not to. She slain the blood of prophets and saints. Babylon needs to fall. It needs to. It doesn't matter that we're used to it. It doesn't matter that we built our life here. It doesn't matter that we're comfortable with it anymore or that we're become so used to the sin that it's just a way of life. It needs to fall. and Christ needs to come and be king. It seems so obvious now, and yet we attach ourselves to it more than we ought to. I was reading this, pardon me, but as I was reading this, it reminded me of The Lord of the Rings. Sorry. We know the story. Some of us know the story. The whole book, the gigantic book, is prefaced around the fact that the evil ring of power has to be destroyed in Mount Doom. The whole story can be summarized in that one thing. The ring needs to be destroyed. It is evil. It's not worth it. It must be destroyed. That's the whole story. Every single battle that is fought, every single conversation that is had, every character that is introduced, every step that is taken is all centered around that one action. The ring needs to be destroyed. You get to the very last book. Everything is going on. Everyone's trying to buy Frodo and Sam time so that he can get to Mount Doom when nobody's watching and he can drop the ring into the fires of Mount Doom. And at the very end, Tolkien did this on purpose because he wanted to embed a principle in here, and that is true. Frodo gets to the top, and he chooses to keep the ring. Some of us know the story. There was a point there. Frodo was the protagonist. He was the good guy of the story. He was the one who did everything. He was the one who said, oh, I even wish the ring had never come to me. And so he's the one who's doing the right thing, and yet he gets to the end, and he's been so influenced by it that when the time comes, he needs to let it die. He can't. And why did he do that? It's because that's a decision we all make. It doesn't matter that you're the Sunday school teacher and that you've been the one telling everybody to get away from the world and you need to avoid the sin of the world and you need to let it go by. You need to allow it to be destroyed. You need to become close to Christ. And as the world falls, don't be a part of it. It doesn't matter that I'm the one preaching this message. When the time comes when we know that the world will no longer be a part of our life and we have to make the decision between the two, some of us will find that we're a lot more attached to it than we like to think that we are. And when we finally realize, well, I can't have it anymore, we'll choose to keep it. And we'll be like Lot, and we'll linger in Sodom when we know it's going to burn. That takes me to point number three. Let Babylon fall because it's certain that it will. We need to let Babylon fall because it needs to. And that goes right into this one. We need to let Babylon fall because it is only the worst part of us that wants it to stand. So, I told you I was going to talk about the kings and the merchants and the shipmasters. That's what the rest of this chapter is. You have three different groups who stand back and they watch as the city burns. The kings, the merchants, and the shipmasters. They all stand back because it's falling apart and they all weep because it fell. Why do they weep? Loss of the life, the people, all my friends, all my family. Or, no, this isn't right. God isn't good to us. None of that. No. You know why they weep? Because everything that they lost. Speaking of Sodom, though, what was the sin of Sodom? Well, homosexuality. Sure. But did Lot stay in Sodom because he was a homosexual? I mean, we should ask his wife whether or not he was. That would be a good question. I don't think so. In fact, the book of Ezekiel tells us what the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah was. It's not that it wasn't homosexuality. He says, what was the sin of thy sister Sodom? He said, pride, abundance of idleness, and fullness of bread. What was their problem? They wanted to make a name for themselves. They wanted to have all that they wanted, even if they had to go to Sodom to get it, and they wanted to be able to relax in it. So Lot had built his life. He's now sitting at the gate. He had built a life for himself. He had a good family. He had a good home. He had plenty to eat in his cupboard. And he could relax in it. So why didn't he want to leave? Because of pride, abundance of idleness, and fullness of bread. When he chooses to mention all the sin of Sodom, that's what he mentions, because that's what holds on, that's what we hold on to. That's what we're worried. That's why he vexed his righteous soul from day to day and seeing and hearing, because it bothers me all the sin, but if I have to get what I need to make a career, to have my cupboards full, and to feel like I can rest in security in what I have, if I have to do it in Sodom, then I will. And he says to his people, if we have to do it in Babylon, then we will. And that's what all these kings and merchants and priests are doing. You talk about power. Look at verse number 9. Look at verse 9. The kings of the earth who have committed fornication and lived deliciously with her shall bewail her and lament for her when they shall see the smoke of her burning, standing afar off for the fear of her torment, saying, alas, alas, that great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour is thy judgment come. So the kings of the earth that committed fornication with her and lived deliciously, their power and prestige was directly connected to the power and prestige of Babylon. So as Babylon falls, so does their career. And they mourn for it. We have this incessant desire to rise to the top of the ladder, no matter what the ladder is. I just talked to the kids in Old Testament survey. We went through the law. We just finished the law, so everyone can breathe, because the Pentateuch's really hard. And we walked through in the book of Numbers the story of Korah. Remember that story? Moses is in charge. Aaron is the high priest. But some of the people in Israel don't like it, because it's not, you know, them. So you have some Levites. Korah, he's a son of Kohath. He gets to move the temple furniture. He gets to be one of the family that gets to be really close to the tabernacle. And then, of course, you have the firstborn. Dathan and Abiram show up, and they're like, well, we're of the tribe of Reuben. We should have more of this. Who is Moses? And who is this Aaron? And so they start to raise a rebellion against them. And so Moses, from the Lord, they end up telling them, everybody who's with Korah, stand on one side, and everybody who's with, you know, me, and therefore Moses, stand on the other side. And he says, I have not sent Moses and Aaron if Korah and his men die a normal death. But if something, I don't know, new were to happen, like the earth would swallow them up, then we'll know. Who's standing with Korah? People. On that day, when that option is presented before them, people stand with Korah. Why? Because it doesn't matter what position is in front of you, we want it. Moses is not a king. He is the leader of a group of nomads that have no land or soldiers or money. But that's the position that's there, and it's not fair that you have it and I don't. And so a large group of people chose to stand with Korah, and the earth swallowed them up. But we will do ridiculous things and swallow a lot of wickedness if it's handed to us with a position of power. By the way, I have to tell you this. My students, we were talking about Korah, and it was like, and the earth swallowed them up. And several of my students said, God grounded them. So, and I laughed. Anyway, Pastor, you know, I got to tell you, I'm really troubled with my job. Yeah, what's going on, Frank? Well, you know, the stuff that's going on in the world, all this change of philosophy and thinking about, you know, whatever, what's right and what's wrong, sin, gender, it's all up in the corporate, you know, whatever. But it's trickling more and more and more down the ladder into my job. And now I have to agree with it, and I have to sign off on it, and I'm being attached to it. And I feel like I just can't do it anymore. I feel like I can't serve God and still have this position, Pastor. Well, you know, if that's what God wants you to do, you know, he'll provide for you, yeah. Hey, Frank, how's your job doing? Hey, no, it's actually been good because last week they offered me a promotion. So I think things are going to be going well now. So nothing changed, but I'm willing to swallow more of it because it was handed to me with more position. The kings of the earth weren't mad that Babylon fell because, oh, I loved Babylon. They were mad because they lost something from it. Then we look at the merchants. The merchants. Look at verse number, whatever the next one is, verse 11. Why do they cry? Because of the loss of life? Because of all the people? No, because Babylon was where they got rich. Look at this. Verse 11. The merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, for no man buyeth their merchandise anymore.
Like, you can hardly take that verse seriously.
Oh, no. Oh, my orders. Oh, I can't fulfill them anymore. I had so many. Oh.
And that's what they're responding. And they go on. The merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls. Money. Fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet. Luxuries. All the thying wood and all manner vessels of ivory and manner vessels of most precious wood and brass and iron and marble, the things that we use. Cinnamon, odors and ointments and frankincense and wine, things to adorn ourselves with. Oil, fine flour and wheat, the things that we consume. Beasts and sheep and horses and chariots, all the tools that we use. And slaves and souls of men. Now, all this is one sentence. Remember how the sentence started. No man buyeth their merchandise anymore, colon, the merchandise of, list. End of verse 13, and slaves and souls of men. They're mourning the death of other people? No, they're mourning because they can't make any money off of slave trading anymore. Their business is gone. Who's going to buy the slaves that I kidnapped? Ugh, got nothing to do anymore. And they wept because Babylon fell. And so they lost money. That's why Lot stayed in. He had a good job. Of course, it's going to be gone tomorrow, but still, I got a good job here. Everything we build here on this earth will be gone tomorrow. Maybe not tomorrow, but soon. And yet we're like, but man, I worked so hard for all that. And they will be willing to swallow a lot of wickedness if it's handed to them with a check. Look at verse 14. That was the merchants. Let's talk about the shipmasters. The fruits that thy soul lusted after are departed from thee, and all the things which were dainty and goodly are departed from thee. Now shalt find them no more at all. The merchants of these things which were made rich by her shall stand afar off for the fear and by torment, weeping and wailing, and saying, alas, alas, or woe, woe, that great city that was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls. Remember all the promises that she made in the last chapter? And she was desolate last chapter, and so now they are too. In 1 hour, so great riches is come to naught. You know how many times Jesus says that's going to happen? Riches shall certainly make themselves wings, and they shall fly away as an eagle toward heaven. In 1 hour, such great riches come to naught. So the shipmasters, verse 17. Every shipmaster and all the company and ships and sailors, as many as trade by sea, stood afar off and cried when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what city is likened to this great city? They cast dusts on their heads and cried, weeping and wailing. So they didn't just like shed a tear. They violently moaned because of the loss. Alas, that great city wherein were made rich all that had ships. Know who that is? That was them. Remember, they're the shipmasters. In the sea by reason of her costliness, for in 1 hour is she made desolate. Why is everybody crying for Babylon? Because Babylon's where they made money. We'll hesitate to stand for truth because we're afraid that we might not be able to get a bigger house if we do. We'll hesitate to do what is right because we're afraid we're not going to get that raise next year. We will sacrifice a lot of righteousness in our life and swallow a lot of wickedness in our testimony if we're going to get money and stuff to do it. Babylon needs to fall because it's only the worst part of you that wants it to stand. So Lot's running out of Sodom, and God tells him to do something. Don't look back. He says this. It doesn't matter you built your life in Sodom. It doesn't matter you have a good career. It doesn't matter that you have a lot of stuff. It doesn't matter you have a good family. It's going to burn. Yeah. Lot, listen to me. Let it. Yeah.
leave and let it burn behind you. But Lot's wife, but it's everything I know, it's everything I love, it's everything we have. And she looked back and lost everything anyway, became a pillar of salt. Jesus is telling us about the end in Luke chapter 17. If you're really fast, you can turn to it, because this is the last place I'm going to be, and then we're going to be done. Surprise. So am I. It's okay. Luke 17. And he's telling us what the end's going to be like. And he says a couple things. He says everyone's going to act like everything's normal until it's not, and Christ returns and puts all of it down. So it's going to be like the days of Noah. Everyone's eating and drinking, marriage, given to marriage, all that stuff. And then the flood came, and everyone was surprised. Even though, you know, Noah, a preacher of righteousness, 2 Peter 2, had been preaching this whole time, suddenly big surprise, because we're too focused on today. Jesus goes on in verse number 28 of Luke 17, and he says it will also be like the days of Lot. Verse 28, they did eat, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they builded. But the same day, in 1 hour, just like Babylon fall, on the same day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even thus shall it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. Watch, listen. Chapter 19 of Revelation. Even shall it be. In that day, he which shall be upon the housetop and his stuff in the house, let him not come down to take it away. And he that's in the field, let him likewise not return back. Remember Lot's wife, he says. Whosoever shall seek to save his life, this is the next verse, all this is in order, shall lose it. But whosoever shall lose his life shall preserve it. We are so busy trying to give ourselves a life that Babylon cannot promise us. It promises us joy and individuality and bread and light and love and cannot give it. The Bible tells us it will fall and will have no more at all to give you. And yet we will linger in Babylon, linger in Sodom. Or even though we know it's all going to fall apart and we just long to stay, but it's not worth it. And our desperate attempt to give ourselves all that God designed us to desire, we will look for it in the wrong place and we will lose it all anyway. And so he says to them in chapter 18, as everything's blowing up and everything's falling apart, and as Babylon is falling and the people listening to this should be rejoicing, he says, listen to me, my people are going to be in there. Come out. Don't be partakers of its ways, so you're not partakers of its plagues. You don't need to fall with Babylon. You can be there, ready and waiting, looking for things above, not on things of this earth. And if you don't seek to try to give yourself that life in the ways of this world, then you will find it. Let Babylon fall.